Well, hello everyone. Welcome to another episode of Spotlight Interview. Today as our guest we have Joe De Niro. Conducting the interview will be Lou Liotta. Our two recorders are Dennis and Becky. I'd like to thank all four of you for hopefully making this another great interview. That being said, I'm going to turn it over to Lou for the rest of the interview. It's all yours, Lou.
Thanks, Mike. My name is Lou Liotta, and I'm going to be the host of your Spotlight program today. And this program appears, I guess, every 2 weeks, and the next event will be probably the 26th of March. And we'll be having interesting people on here every 2 weeks. You know, we're living in an age today where people are looking for heroes. Sports heroes, people who have made millions of dollars, people who have married rock stars, people who have made famous records in flying around the world or going out into space or something like that. We're all looking for extraordinary people. But you know, there aren't many of those. There aren't many of those at all. What we get, typically, is people like you and me. Ordinary people. Just living our lives, meeting challenges. Of course, we're heroes to our friends and our families. But no one else knows about that. But occasionally, and through the auspices of FTP and other media outlets, we do find out about ordinary people who are not so ordinary once you look into their lives. The things they've encountered, the obstacles they've overcome, and some of them, their lives are just in process. They're not over. The story is not closed. It's not end. You can't say fini, because they're going to go on, and in their own way, they're going to live lives that are memorable to them and to those who love them. Well, you say, what's all this leading up to? What's he talking about? Well, what I'm talking about is someone you all know, and my guest today is Joe De Niro. You've heard his voice. You've heard his music. And Joe is... yeah, I guess in a way, an average Joe. Or is he? We're going to explore that. We're going to explore that today. See how average he is. How unheroic or heroic he is. Because to his family, he is a hero. He's a rock. And you'll see the way he feels about his family. And the sacrifices he's made for his family. And you'll get to know Joe. Not Joe the Rock Shop producer. Not Joe the FTP radio manager. Although he's that. You're going to see a different side of Joe. You're going to hear a story which in some ways is going to be very, very common. You'll say, I've heard that. That's not much. Oh? Would you have liked to have lived it? Would you have liked to have had the crises he's had and overcome them in the way he's overcome them? So, I guess that's enough of me, and we're going to start hearing from Joe. Joe, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
Well, Joe, I'm at the western end of New York, and where are you?
I'm your neighbor to the south. I live in a little town, well... not so little, but a town of about 14,000 people called Ronkonkoma. It's on Long Island, New York, and I live approximately 60 miles east of New York City.
Yeah, the great metropolitan New York metropolitan area. Now, you didn't always live out in Long Island, did you? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Queens, New York. I basically, from the age of about 5 on, I lived in Queens, New York.
Yeah, you attended schools out there, public schools. Oh, you did wear glasses, I think you told me, but a lot of people wear glasses. No inkling of what was going to come, right?
Correct. I've worn glasses since approximately 4 or 5 years of age.
Yeah, Joe was one of those four eyes. You've seen them in school. People make fun of them. They used to make fun of me. I used to wear glasses. Yeah, just wearing glasses, getting along, working his way through school. And then you went through high school and you graduated. And then what happened, Joe?
After I graduated high school, I attended for 1 year Queens College, which is in Queens, New York, and I only attended 1 year. I basically dropped out after 1 year.
Yeah, I guess that would be considered an ordinary failure, right? A lot of people flunk out or drop out. Were you a party boy? Did you have a drug or alcohol problem at that time, Joe?
No, it wasn't that. It's just, at the time, I wasn't, I guess, mature enough to handle. I've always done well in a structured setting, and a tightly structured setting, and going from, you know, the structure of high school to the lack of structure in college, where, you know, a professor does not care if you show up. He gets his paycheck one way or the other. He doesn't care if you're hanging out in the student union, you know, shooting pool with your friends or doing all that sort of thing. And I just wasn't prepared for it. And, you know, basically that was the down, or, you know, my lack of succeeding at that point.
Yeah, that sounds pretty ordinary. You were a child, you were born in 1968, so you would have been in your teens in the 80s. You're a child of the 80s. Just coast, have a good time. Unless you're told to do something, you don't do it. Yeah, well, most of us are like that, right? But there was some tension at home, wasn't there, over this, after this graduation. What was the tension all about in your home life?
Well, after I dropped out, I was basically for approximately 6 months after I dropped out, I was just, you know, hanging out with my friends. I was, you know, playing my guitar and, you know, playing with my band and that sort of thing, and just, for lack of a better term, being a bum. And about 6 months after I had dropped out, my mom basically turned the screws on me and said, "You need to do something. You need to either go back to school or you need to get a job, and, you know, and basically start doing something." And my dad. You know, was basically on the same page as her, and you know, kind of approached me from a different standpoint. He's like, you know, you really should just, you know, go out and get, you know, some sort of job. Doesn't matter what it is, even if it's minimum wage, but just something. You know, take up your time. You know, make some money, and you know, until you figure out what you want to do. Until you figure out if you want to go back to school or not. You know, just, you know, kind of do something for the meantime.
Yeah, the parents discussed it. They said, Joe, they decided Joe's got to do something. What are we going to do? His band, he's a musician of sorts. He's got a band, but it's not going anywhere. He's hanging out with his buddies. Doesn't that sound pretty commonplace to all of us? Sure it does. So you did something, didn't you, Joe? You had to. It was either get a job or what, move out?
I don't know if it was that, but, you know, I mean, I never got a, you know, one of those type of ultimatums, but, you know, it may have led to that had I, you know, not, you know, followed through.
Well, you were kind of drifting, right? You were drifting. And your dad saw, gave you some little direction, little push, and you found a job. Not a very impressive job, right? According to the jobs today, not very impressive. But you did it. Well, what did you start doing?
My very first job, my dad actually went with me. He said, you know, you got to do something. And, you know, we went through the paper, all the things that, you know, no experience necessary. And it was, you know, security positions. It was, you know, basically at that time, like, I think it was like $5.50 an hour. It was a little bit above minimum wage, but, you know. So, I went to this security company, and they offered me three different positions. They offered me, like, a job in, like, a men's shelter overnight, and they offered me a job in the afternoon at one of the city hospitals, and they finally offered me, and they actually came up with this at the last minute. They offered me this job at the Holiday Inn at LaGuardia Airport. And it was Monday to Friday, 8 o'clock in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. They gave you a meal for free and weekends off. And that's where I started. I started working at the Holiday Inn as a security guard.
Yeah, I've never stayed at the Holiday Inn at LaGuardia, although I've been in LaGuardia Airport. Was that a pretty good motel, hotel?
At the time I was working there, when I first started working there, there was three major properties there. There was a Marriott, there was this, and there was also a Ramada Inn. And this was probably three and a half star caliber hotel, the Marriott being a 4-star hotel, and the Ramada was also a three and a half star caliber hotel.
So this is a reputable motel. This wasn't a hot sheet spot, right? This is a reputable hotel. Motel, I should say.
It was actually a full-service hotel. Food and beverage operation, gift shop, whole soup to nuts. It was 224-room property. It was full-service hotel.
Well, I guess we've got the picture. You had to get a job. Your security man at the Holiday Inn at LaGuardia Airport, New York City, Queens. Now, did something happen along the way here? What were you feeling like when you took that job and you had it for a few months? What did something begin to happen to you?
Well, I enjoyed the interaction with people. You know, day to day you were dealing with, you know, with guests, and the job suited me quite well, because, you know, I enjoyed interacting with people on a day to day basis. I could never see myself just sitting at a desk and sitting at a computer or doing paperwork just, you know, for 8 hours a day. That wasn't for me. So I enjoyed that, and, you know, I wanted to, you know, I guess move up. And my boss at the time, the security manager, actually, within 2 months of me being there, actually promoted me to one of the supervisors at the hotel.
Yeah. The long ladder that you're going to climb. Only it's not going to be that long. You're going to move up pretty rapidly in that organization, aren't you? Why don't you trace that out a little bit for us? From security guard to what, Joe?
Well, do you want to know from the starting point to end point full detail, or just want where I wound up when I left?
We'll just take it step by step. I want to show people the slow climb, but it really wasn't that slow. because you had a lot of ability. You just hadn't been using it up until this time, like most of us. You know, we have to be pushed a little bit. But now you start to get something going within yourself. How did you move up?
Within a year of me working at the hotel, the front office manager was a friend of mine. Funny enough, her brother is actually a very big time manager in the rock and roll business. He's fairly reputable at this point in time, and he was doing promotions work. So we had this common rock and roll bond thing. So we'd always hang out and chit chat. And there was a position that opened up on the weekends as a part time switchboard operator. 2 days a week, and it was 16 hours of work. And I had inquired about it. You know, I wanted to keep my security position, but, you know, I figured, you know, this is a good way to, you know, kind of move into actually working for the hotel and moving up, because I had a desire to work my way up. You know, I had decided at that point that, you know, this was definitely something that suited me, you know, being in the hotel business.
Yeah, I think we're getting the picture. We're getting the picture now. From no job to two jobs at once. All of a sudden now you're working 16, 18 hours a day, two jobs. Now, somewhere along that line, when did you start showing or have an interest in computers? Because you're self-taught in computers. Is that right?
Yes, totally self-taught. I've never had one computer lesson ever in my life.
So how you acquired this knowledge on the job or at home or with friends? How did that happen?
Just basically learning on the job. The hotel had its own proprietary property management system. That's basically the reservations, checking in and out, some of the back office accounting, and then they also had, at that time, DOS-based PCs that were, you know, they would have like Lotus 1-2-3 and WordPerfect in it for, you know, some other, you know, some more additional back office accounting and, you know, to be able to do, you know, word processing.
Yeah, so this caught your interest. The computer, the programs caught your interest. And you began to begin to get some expertise in that area, is that right?
Yeah, it was something I just instinctively, I guess, picked up on. It just, you know, I had no problem, you know, someone could teach me something on a computer. I remember when, I'll fast forward just a little, typically, my next step up in the hotel was being a front office clerk, and typically, the front office clerks were given 4 weeks of training. That way they really knew the computer system in and out, and, you know, all the other aspects of, you know, working the front desk. For me, I was because of the situation that when the position opened up, they were desperate to have somebody in there and they didn't have the time. And I was able to basically be up and running in 4 days' time.
Okay. So you took this job at 19 years old, and 7 years later, at about 26, what were you at 26 years old with no courses in computers, no courses in hotel management, no courses in business management? What had you become at age 26, Joe? And you're supposed to be a regular Joe now. I don't think this is too regular. Tell us.
I was 25. I was the assistant general manager for the property.
From security guard to general manager of a full service motel, hotel, in the biggest city in the Northeast, in America, New York City. That's pretty unusual, Joe. And how did that go? Once you became general manager, was everything smooth and pleasant? Was the ownership happy with you?
Oh, absolutely. I enjoyed what I did day in, day out. People that I worked for, the management company that was running the property at the time, was happy with my work. The only reason I had left the hotel at all, I had left the hotel on two separate occasions. A year previous, I had left for about 9 months to pursue a computer job, and I had taken a leave of absence, and then I'd come back, and the reason I ultimately left is the ownership of the property had changed, and there was a different management company that came in place, and basically, you know, the previous management team left with the sale.
So the hotel job ends not because of what you did, but because management changed, ownership changed, and you were thinking ahead, and you were thinking, hey, maybe this computer thing might be something I could get into. Who'd you go to work for? What did you do in that computer field?
I worked for a company called Hotel Software Systems. They were based out of Baltimore. And basically how that job came about was I was literally on the phone one day on a, you know, we had some sort of issue, and I was actually joking with the tech support guy, you know, because they never needed to really help me too much. They just needed to help me to really get into the programming language for bigger problems. I could get in around most aspects of the software on my own. And I was joking with the guy one day that, you know, I know this software so well, you know, you guys should just hire me. Well, within 5 minutes, I was on the phone with, they actually happened to have a job open for an installer. And within 5 minutes, I was on the phone with the CEO of the company, and a week later, I was on a train down to Baltimore to interview for the position.
Yeah, and you got that position, didn't you? And how did that job go? Were you stationed in Baltimore, or did you travel around the country installing the software?
Well, it really wasn't much of an interview. They basically hired me. I had a 5-minute interview, and it was basically based on the recommendation of one of the people that had installed our system. And my job was basically installing all of the hardware and software in a property, and it, putting in all the PCs, doing all the wiring, all setting up the networks, and then, you know, installing software, configuring it, and then inevitably training all the personnel in how to utilize it. And it was a traveling job, and it involved me. I could install anywhere in the United States or Canada.
And you did that, and you were good at it. But, of course, it looked like that was going to be your career, did it not, at that point? Or were you getting sick of it? Were you getting sick of the traveling?
Well, at the time, the company I worked for was actually the fastest growing property management company in the hotel business. So they were growing just way too fast, and they weren't able to keep up with the amount of sales they were doing, and they didn't have enough qualified people on the road to do these installations. These installations could take anywhere from a minimum of 7 days for a basic property to up to four. You know, I've been on properties where it was 14 or 17 days because they had, you know, a restaurant, a bar, a gymnasium, a hair salon, and all these things have to be incorporated, and you have to train all these different aspects of personnel on this software. And, you know, when I was hired for the position, I was told I would be on the road for, you know, 3 weeks at a time, and then off for a week or two, and then back on the road for 3 weeks, which was fine. But what inevitably happened, because they were so overwhelmed with orders, is they kept their installers out for 7-8 weeks at a time, and I just burnt out, because I was doing not only the training on the job, but I was doing also after hours support one or two nights a week as well. This is they went from a mom and pop operation to a major corporation, and they just did not have the personnel to back it up. So I just got burnt out.
Well, I certainly can understand that. Traveling does that to a lot of people. Burns them out. Well, now you're about age 26, right? And everything's going pretty well. You're tired of the traveling. Yeah, that's burning you out. But you're doing a good thing. You've mastered this job, self-taught. You're getting along with a host of people all over the country. You're training them, showing them how the thing works, how to solve problems. And when did you first notice something was not quite right about your vision?
I had been noticing for a couple of years. The only thing I really truly noticed was that my night vision was getting poorer. Nothing dramatic, but definitely was getting poorer. But that was the only real inkling that I had that there was anything even wrong.
Yeah, it was kind of sneaky, wasn't it? Crept up on you. But there came a point when you said, "Hey, there's something wrong here. I got to go to ophthalmologist and check this out." Tell us about that. That going to that ophthalmologist and what you heard and how you felt after it.
Well, actually, it wasn't even related to that. I was actually going to I was wearing glasses at the time, or contact lenses. I was wearing either or, and I really wanted to get away from glasses altogether. And I looked into, at the time it was called radial carotomy. And it's a form of laser surgery that was available at that time. There's far more advanced types of laser surgery now, but at that time that's what I was looking into. So I went to an ophthalmologist group looking into that. So they do this very thorough eye exam, and then I saw three different ophthalmologists plus an optometrist in the span of, you know, about an hour and a half. And finally the head guy for the group comes in and, you know, basically tells me, you know, you have very unhealthy eyes. So, you know, I'm like, what are you talking about? And he says, you have this condition called retinitis pigmentosa. So, you know, ever the young optimist that I was, you know, I'm like, okay. Can I still get the laser surgery, and what do we do to get rid of this retinitis pigmentosa thing? And he's like, it's untreatable. So I'm like, okay, well, you know, what does this mean? You know, what's the upshot here, you know? And, you know, what he said was, you know, I can't give you a firm answer. You know, you could go blind tomorrow, you could go blind 50 years from now, you could never go blind. Your vision might fall off 20% for the rest of your life, might fall off 50%, you might go blind next week. Every case is different. and I was floored. I was just absolutely floored by that. And my brother had driven me there, and I remember, you know, it's the only time I've ever cried about this whole thing. And, you know, I was diagnosed in April of 1994. It'll be 11 years, you know, next month. And it was the only time I ever cried. And I remember crying all the way home, you know, thinking, you know, I'm going blind. I am going blind.
Yeah, you couldn't have heard worse news. You're totally unprepared psychologically for that blow, as most of us have been over the years. I think everyone can relate to that, especially if it happened in your teenage years or early 20s or 30s or even 40s. You just don't know how to handle it initially. And you feel sorry for yourself. We all have. Very ordinary. And yet, you weren't self-pitying. How did you handle that news after you got home and thought about it for a couple of weeks? This is a little unusual, I think. Did you go into a deep depression? Did you go out drinking? Did you take on more drugs? How did you handle it? Tell us how, you know, regular Joe handles that.
From the very next day, I just, you know, I said, you know, to my, I basically was like, you know what, a lot worse things in life, you know, there's, you know, we'll just adapt. We'll adapt. I remember calling the CEO. I was working for the computer company at that time. And I called the CEO, and I basically, you know, said, I got this thing, and, you know, I basically laid it out on the line, and I said, you know, I don't know what's going on here, and, but, you know, I don't want to stop working, you know, and he's like, and he's like, don't worry about it. We, you know, the programming that we had, you know, he's like, oh, we can adjust the fonts. You know how to do that, and you can adjust all the colors, and you can do all this stuff. You know, you could do whatever you need to do with the programming, you know, so you can get it, you know, to the point where people, you know, once the personnel's in place, I don't need to see the screen anymore. I just need to program the background aspect of it. So that just, you know, that conversation with him, I was like, you know what, this is not going to stop me. I'm not going to let this stop me. I'm going to continue living my life, you know, and, you know, I used to travel at, you know, I still do, but you know, I love traveling. You know, it was not beyond me to hop on a plane and do a, you know, fly to Miami for 3 or 4 days and just hang out and go see the sights and lay on the beach. So I wasn't going to let this stop me living my life. Absolutely not.
Well, you used a word which I've often used and many other people have used. You said, I'm going to adapt. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to adapt. Adapt to a devastating blow like that? But that's what you decided to do. Adapt. And that was the beginning of recovery, wasn't it? You weren't going to let it beat you. And after this blow that you got from your ophthalmologist, this bad news, you handled that. But things started to get even better, didn't they, 6 months after you met someone?
Yeah, I was diagnosed in April of 1994. I met my wife in November of 1994.
Yeah, you met your future wife, and you were going blind at this time. And you told her. And how did she react? Well, we'll see you, Joe, or we'll work this out, Joe. How did she react? How did this lady react to this?
Basically, she had the same philosophy as I did, that, you know, we deal with things as they come. We collectively will adapt.
Now that's what I call meeting a lifelong partner. She was going to adapt with you. And you eventually married her, didn't you?
Yeah, I met my wife in November of 1994. Approximately a month after I met her, we were engaged, and 8 months after that, we were married.
That sounds beautiful. Well, you got married, but you noticed that vision was getting worse all the time, wasn't it? Slowly, especially the night vision. And being a man who thinks about what he's doing, you started to make some strategic moves for future employment, didn't you, Joe? What were they?
Well, after I left the hotel, the company I worked for offered me the opportunity to relocate to one of the cities was Cincinnati. I forget where the other one was at the time, but I didn't want to relocate. I was about to get married in 3 months. All my family's here. All my wife's family was here, and I just did not want to do that. And you know, I knew what my vision situation was, and I didn't want to go to a strange place. So I looked into working into hotels in Manhattan, but the money was far less than what I had been getting paid, and basically the upshot of that was I was working in Queens, and the New York City market is different, and I would have had to take a step back in position to basically get a job, and with taking that step back in position, I would have had to take a money loss, and I wasn't willing to do that. So for initially, my first job after the hotel was just a retail job selling computers, and I did that for about 6 months. And after that, I knew my vision was starting to get worse. I noticed that at the retail position. And I'd always wanted to do something from home. And so I started my own business.
Yes, you started your own business from home. Now, a lot of visually impaired people think about that. Gee, if I could just work from my home, I wouldn't have the travel problem. I wouldn't have all that hassle. This is something I could really like. I'd really like to do this, run a business. And you see ads on the internet and on radio and TV. Be your own boss. Run your own business from your home. Make a big salary. And you tried it, but not because you saw those ads, but because you were thinking, you know, I like music. I know computers. Could I set up a online business selling CDs? Of course, today would be DVDs. So you got some money together, I guess, family, maybe your wife, and you started a mail order business online selling music. How did that go, Joe?
I love music. I love it so much that, you know, if somebody came into my house right now and said, you know, you got to give up one of two things, your television or your stereo. My television would be out the door quicker than, you know, you could blink your eyes. And I'm fairly knowledgeable of music artists, various genres of music, et cetera, and, at the time, the internet was a brand new thing, and I saw it as a good opportunity to venture into, this new realm people were getting on the internet, just left, right, and center. It was just growing exponentially. Day in, day out, the amount of people that were getting on the internet. And I decided to start an online CD business, and it was specific. It was rock and roll music, and it was imported titles basically from all the European markets and the Asian markets and Australia. I carried no domestic release CDs. I carried strictly imports. And I ran that business for about a year.
And you made some money at it. You supported yourself. Of course, your wife was working in Manhattan at this time. She had a pretty good job, although she did help you. I think you told me she did help you. But at some point you decided, yeah, I'm on the ground floor with this CD online business, but I don't have capital to expand it. What did you decide? It didn't fail. You dropped it before it failed, right?
Yes, we were making money. We were making a lot of money, but we were, you know, we were making money. But you know, it certainly wasn't a lot of money, or I would still be doing it. But in order for me to take the next step, I would have had to infuse a lot more capital into the business, and you know, it was just a risk that I wasn't willing to take. It was. You know, it was one of those hit or miss things, and I made the decision that, you know, I gave this a shot. I felt that, you know, the amount of business that I grew, I wasn't sure if the business would grow enough based on, you know, based on the investment I would have to put in, and I wasn't willing to take that chance.
Well, I've got two questions. One, the first one is, did you dabble in any other entrepreneurial activities, either in Long Island or in Manhattan? Did you get in any other businesses as a partner or investor?
No. I was doing... It wound up making me money. I was also involved in a hobby. I love the Hard Rock cafes. They used to have these lapel. They still do. These lapel pins, guitar pins, and all, you know, drum pins, and all these holiday pins. And I used to collect those. And I also used to buy, sell, and trade those as well. So I also did that. It made me a lot of money doing that, but it wasn't, I guess, a formal business per se. It was more a hobby, but out of that hobby, it actually generated a lot of money for me.
I see. Well, that's interesting. The other question, I have a few more questions for you, but the next question I have for you relates to your love of music, and it relates back to an answer you gave me earlier. You said when you got that news from the ophthalmologist that you were eventually going to go blind, you felt sorry for yourself initially, and then you turned it around and you said, I'm going to adapt. How did music help you adjust to this very, very bad news that you were going to lose your sight? Was music important there?
Music... Yeah. Music is always, as a guitar player, it's always been an outlet of expression for me. Also, as somebody who would write songs and write lyrics. So, absolutely, it was a way of me expressing. You know, frustration at times. Absolutely.
Well, would you say your psychological reaction to this news of you're going to eventually go blind, did it make you angry? Was that an emotion you felt? Damn it! I'm mad about this, but I'm gonna adapt. I'm gonna conquer this thing. I'm gonna live with it. Was it anger?
There was some anger. I find myself, you know, every now and then getting angry. You know, I'll be in the kitchen and, you know, trying to, you know, get dinner on and trying to do something that, you know, 3 years ago was a piece of cake, but now it's, you know, it's a little bit more tougher. I need, you know, a little hand with it. And, you know, that frustrates me like no end. It frustrates, you know, I just, you know, there are times, you know, I want to take the mixing bowl and just throw it against the wall because, you know, there's something I'm not, you know, I can't do, or, it's just taking me that much longer, and it, you know, it just seems almost tedious. So, you know, I had anger crop up here and there. It's not a lot, but it does pop up.
Yeah, and when you did get angry, I suppose you channeled that into constructive activities. I want to ask you one other thing. The story you told me, because you were losing your sight and because you couldn't see very well at night, and you didn't want to use the cane, because everyone, you know, we all know that's a symbol of a disability, a handicap. Everyone knows that symbol. You didn't want to use a cane. And you took a trip to Manhattan to meet your wife for lunch. Tell us how that feeling of denial all of a sudden changed. What happened to you to change your feeling towards the cane and your impending visual impairment? What happened in Manhattan?
When I eventually got the cane, I probably should have had a cane probably at least minimum a year before, maybe even 2 years before, just for night travel. But what finally did it for me was I was meeting my wife. We were going to go. I think we were going to a Broadway show, and She had just changed companies, so it was only maybe my second or third time going to her new office, so I wasn't familiar with the route. And she works on Madison Avenue, and there's a lot of high-end retail stores on Madison Avenue, and they've got these huge, big, you know, 1-inch, 2-inch thick glass doors. And at that point, I was already actually, you know, when I would walk, you know, I would walk probably a little bit slower than I had normally walked. And I was probably a block away from her office, and one of the stores had the plate glass door wide open. And I was kind of hugging the building, and I didn't see it, and I walked right into it. And you know, I'm a big guy. I'm 6'3". I'm built like a bodybuilder. I'm, you know, 240 pounds, and the only thing that saved me from knocking that glass door off its hinges and like shattering into a bazillion pieces and wrecking me was the fact that I was walking a little bit slower. And I was stunned, and I said, no more. You know, no more. I don't care what the heck, you know, that cane symbolizes. I am not doing this. I was tired of things like that. I could have caused major damage to myself. You know, and I was tired of walking into people and people looking at me like, you know, what are you, blind? Yeah, I'm going blind. About time people knew that. And that was it. I was done. We weren't walking into glass doors anymore.
Yes. And you tell that quite well. From adapting to anger to tolerating, now you were getting to the point where you're accepting the inevitable. You had to use a cane. You had to admit publicly, hey, I can't see very well. That's why I'm using this cane. So you took it upon yourself to take up the symbol of blindness because it was necessary. It was for your own safety and for your own, for the safety of others. Well, I think we've all come to that point. As I say, this story is a story we all probably have lived one way or another. We've all experienced these feelings. Now, you have been involved in a lot of humanitarian and charitable work. Would you like to tell us something about some of that? And tell us, you've risen pretty high in one organization. Could you tell us something about that?
Some of the humanitarian work, I told you I used to collect Hard Rock Cafe pins. I did that up until about 2 years ago. And I've done a lot of charity work. I actually used to be the vice president of Hard Rock Cafe Corporate. Has a Hard Rock Cafe Pin Collectors Club. And it's a worldwide club. It has probably 2,000, 3,000 members, maybe even more at this point. I was the vice president of that for a long time. And we used to do these get-togethers where, you know, people would get together, buy, sell, trade pins. But we would also do an auction at any of these events, and it would raise money for a particular cause. So I've done, we've done a couple events in Chicago that raised money for the Why Me Breast Cancer Foundation. In New York City, we've raised money for God's Love We Deliver, which is an organization which delivers meals to people with HIV. I've done charity work overseas. In Stockholm, we did an auction that raised about $50,000 for orphan kids in Russia. We've done things for Give Kids the World, which is an organization that's kind of similar to, well, they provide basically kids who are that have cancer or something that's eventually going to take their lives, you know, basically the opportunity to go to Disney World and that sort of thing. Save the Music. I've done all sorts of different charitable things like that. Within my own community, I go up once a month to our local veterans home, nursing home, and the people that work at the vet's home, I help them get to Mass so they can go to church on Sundays once a month. And basically, the people that work at the home can get the people ready, but they can't leave their stations to take the people down to the common room so they can attend Mass. So they depend on volunteers to do that. So Knights of Columbus have taken that on as a project, and we go there and we take them down, and we make sure they get to Mass, and we make sure that they, you know, get back to their rooms fine. And we also do once a month, we go up there, and this is a different part of the Knights of Columbus, but we go and, you know, play bingo with them and you know, make sure that, you know, they have people there, you know, someone there that's, you know, there to, you know, spend some time with them. Some of these people, they have no families, and, you know, these are veterans. They fought in World War II. They fought in Korea. They fought in Vietnam. They put their lives on the line for us, and that's the least I can do for them. And I do other things in the community as well. You know, just other things within my town.
Yes, and you ought to be commended for that. Instead of sitting at home and listening to music or wallowing in your own problems. You're out there helping other people. I don't know. I don't think that's too ordinary. I think that's extraordinary. Joe, you mentioned to me that your wife, of course, commutes into Manhattan and comes back. She has a long day. And you have two young daughters. And you spoke to me very eloquently about what your hopes for them are, what you want to provide for them. And even though you don't see very well at night, in fact, you can't see very well at night at all, you go out and you take those girls to school and to dance lessons. And how do you feel about what you, as a dad, what do you want to provide for those girls? You can speak at that at length, too.
I have two little girls. My oldest daughter, her name is Anya, she's 6 years old, and my youngest is Katrina, and she's 4 and a half. And my wife, she leaves the house at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's going to Manhattan, and you know, by the time she gets home, it's 7 o'clock in the evening. And the onus is on me. You know, if my children want to do anything extracurricular outside of school, the onus is on me to make that happen for them. And, you know, my children are going to have to, you know, as they grow older, you know, I don't drive, you know. And they're going to, you know, they're going to have enough difficulties with that. But, you know, I refuse to sit at home and cheat my children out of, you know, as normal childhood, you know, as possible. My kids want to, you know, take dance class. They want to play soccer. They want to do brownies. They want to do all the things that other little children do. And I will be damned. I will be damned if my lack of sight and me walking around with a cane is going to prevent that from happening. I will do anything, absolutely anything, to make sure. I do. You know, I take them to dance and make sure that, you know, when they play soccer, that they get to their practices. And, you know, the soccer thing is, it's almost a mile to walk to the soccer field and back. Big deal. You know, you do what you do to get your kids there. And that's my philosophy, is I will not let this stop, you know, my white cane stop them from having as normal a childhood as possible.
That's beautifully said. Thank you, Joe. That was well said. And I think it expresses the inner man in you. Family, you're going to lead as normal a life as you can, and you're certainly going to help your children lead as normal a life as possible. And I think that's ordinary, but it's also extraordinary, isn't it? We're starting to merge here. Regular Joe with Extraordinary Joe. Now, you're now in your mid-40s, and you've been taking care of your children before as preschoolers. Now some are going to school. And you're just on the verge of turning over a new leaf in your life. Where are you going from here, Joe? In your mid-40s, what do you see for the future for yourself?
Well, you're giving me too many years. I'm not to my mid-40s yet. But my youngest daughter will be starting full-time school in September, and it is my desire, and I will, you know, get back into the workforce in some capacity. And I actually want to do something that's again home based, and you know, I'm going to make that happen. I'm going to make that happen. I haven't decided exactly what it is I want to do yet. I'm, exploring a couple options. Probably something computer related. Since we actually last talked, my best friend has actually approached me with a different business opportunity that looks like something I might pursue as well, but I haven't decided what it is, but I'm at the point in my life where, I want to do something professionally again.
Well, I put you in your 40s because I can't add. That's why. No, Joe was born in 1968. He's only in his mid to late 30s. So I stand corrected. And we don't want you to age too fast, Joe. We don't want you to age too fast. So what we can say is that this story is not over. Joe De Niro's story is not over. And there's a future for him because he's that kind of a person who can make his own opportunities, raise his family, educate his children, and be a good dad, as you heard the way he described his feelings towards his children. I think that's extraordinary. And it's, he's like one of us. Joe, I want to thank you so much for being on with me today and sharing your personal story with me and the listeners on FTP. And in 2 weeks, of course, we'll have another interview, hopefully. And I want to thank Mike for his behind-the-scenes efforts in arranging these interviews. And I want to thank Dennis in particular for recording this and editing it and getting it posted so rapidly. Thank you, Dennis. And, of course, we want to thank FTP and Jennifer Thomas for making this time available. I think now, if you have some time, Joe, maybe the audience would like to have some questions. It might have some questions for you. We'll do some for about a few minutes, and then we'll let you go away because I know, enough is enough. Does anyone have any questions for Joe De Niro?
Being of European descent, Joe, how was the family, friends, and relatives, not your immediate family, but extended family, accepting of your vision loss?
My family's always been supportive, my extended family. I actually have an aunt. There was a doctor in Cuba who was apparently doing these treatments for the condition I have in Cuba, and it wound up being proven that the treatment wasn't reputable or not. But when it was first reported about him, she was willing to pay for me to, to go to Canada and then fly from Canada into Cuba. I mean, my aunt, I'm always getting email from her about different new studies that they're doing. I have friends that do the same thing. That they'll send me links to stories on the internet about it. I mean, everybody. I have, a close circle of good friends, and I've got the best family and the best set of friends out there. I can't say enough about what some of these people will do for me. I mean, I have a friend yesterday, my daughter was sick and I had to get her to the doctor, and he lives, probably like 7-8 miles away from me. And, he had to work yesterday afternoon, and, he dropped everything to make sure I got her to the doctor and back, And, this is somebody I've known since he was 4 years old. And just dropped everything for me. And, you know, these are kind of friends and family I have.
Was there another question for Joe?
Are you totally blind now?
No, I still have some vision. I guess I would be still considered a high partial.
Great interview, Joe. One question. Have you had your daughters checked for the RP? And do either one of them have it?
I haven't had... I had my older one. She just... Recently, they found out that she needed glasses, and they looked at her retinas. They did a pretty good workup. They didn't do an ERG and an retinogram, but everything that they looked at indicated that she had healthy retinas. And I haven't done anything with my younger daughter. My younger daughter, at least at this point, you know, indicates that she has perfect vision. I mean, well, probably cross that bridge in a couple of years when she's a little bit older and able to tolerate the testing.
Great.
What is those tests that you're talking about on the ERG and the orthoretinogram? What are those?
Oh, it's ERG is the same thing. It's an electroretinogram, and it's they attach strobes to your eye, and you have to leave your eye open, and then they flash these very intense, very bright lights in your eye, and it's to determine the degeneration of the retina.
Well, this test, Joe, this is Lou, tests the sensitivity or declining sensitivity of the cones and rods in the retina. Is that right?
Yeah, it's the only way that they can truly determine how you're regressing. You know, they can dilate your eyes and look in the back, and they can get a sense, but they can't tell it at the amount of degeneration that's happening year in, year out without doing an ERG.
Now, one thing that Joe hasn't mentioned, I don't think he'll mind, but he tried to research his family background to see if anyone in his family had RP. And on his father's side, there is no evidence of that. But his mother was an orphan who was adopted, and there are no records there, so Joe couldn't research that side of his family. Isn't that right, Joe?
That's correct.
So he's been concerned about that right from the beginning, before he started his family, whether he would pass that on to his young daughters. Joe, you may stay in the room and chat with the audience if you wish, or you may leave. But I want to thank you again for talking with me and sharing your life experiences with the audience. And while you're a regular Joe, I would say in some respects, you're an extraordinary Joe. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.